when character meets crisis.
What I like focusing on is the huge turning point in the narrator's life, the moment where that barrier between personal and professional comes crashing down, and the narrator knows that whatever choice he or she makes, his or her life is never going to be the same place again.
That's mystery novelist Tana French. We talk with her about her latest book in the Dublin Murder Squad series, The Trespasser. Then, how can we best confront the terrible uncertainties of a darkening future?
If we deny that there is a livable future, then we will do little to secure one. If we affirm it, we come into other troubles, such as complacency, an optimistic view that what we are doing now is all that is needed, an iconic focus on the simple solution, or the constant anxiety of life on the edge between hope and doubt.
That was Sean Chamberlain reading the words of the late David Fleming. Chamberlain is the editor of Fleming's posthumously published writings. We talk with him about Fleming's book, Surviving the Future. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us on this station or at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. American-Irish writer Tana French has been called, quote, the most interesting, most important crime novelist to emerge in the past 10 years. Her novels are intimate explorations of character and motive, told in vivid language that fairly leaps off the page. Each novel takes a different detective from the Dublin Murder Squad as its protagonist, preserving the setting of the series, but changing the frame. French's latest in the series is The Trespasser. Its protagonist is the only woman on the squad, Antoinette Conway. She's also multiracial. She's smart, tough, and she has a huge chip on her shoulder. Is it because she's the victim of racist and sexist harassment from her coworkers? Or does her pugnacious defensiveness create her own isolation? Meanwhile, Conway's got a tough case to solve that just might implicate someone in the murder squad itself. Well, Tana French, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me back. It's great to be on.
This was just a terrific book, The Trespasser. And murder mystery in your hands is really a chance to explore the psychology of your characters very deeply. And each book has a different protagonist, unlike a lot of other mystery writers. This one especially focuses on the character of Antoinette Conway, a police detective who was not the main character in the last one, but it is her second appearance. All your books introduce a character that becomes a protagonist in the next book. Why do you structure it this way?
Well, the traditional thing to do with a detective series is to have the main protagonist and follow them straight through. And I love writing series like that. I love reading series like that. But the problem with writing them is that what I like focusing on is the huge turning point in the narrator's life, the moment where that barrier between personal and professional comes crashing down, and the narrator knows that whatever choice he or she makes, his or her life is never going to be the same place again. And the thing is that you don't really actually get that many moments like that in a real life. So when I was coming to the end of my first book, In the Woods, I was thinking, well, either I can keep giving the same narrator huge life-changing moments every couple of years, and he's going to end up in a straitjacket by about book four, or else I can do the traditional thing and follow the detective through the smaller ups and downs of life, which doesn't really interest me as much, or else I can switch narrator. And so I ended up switching narrator. And it also gives me a chance to focus on different themes, because there are only a certain number of preoccupations and themes and, you know, underlying motifs that are core to any one person. And if the theme of the book isn't also a core theme in the life of the detective, you run the risk of having the narrator become a bit disconnected from the book, which I think isn't as strong. So the fact that I'm switching narrator means that I can focus on a different set of themes every time while still having them be absolutely core to the narrator's life, and I like that.
So we talked with you last time about the book The Secret Place, and this time on The Trespasser, what is the shift that you made between that book and this one in terms of how you focused, the theme you focused on?
Well, last time, The Secret Place, it focuses around a group of teenage girls and also around the narrator, Stephen Moran. And for all of them, the core theme is identity and who are you going to allow to define your identity? I mean, for teenagers, that is the core theme very much. How are you going to decide who you are and who are you going to allow to have a hand in that decision? And for Stephen as well, he was very much a people pleaser, somebody who would be anyone else wanted him to be. And so for him, that idea of who's going to decide who you are was also core. But Antoinette is the opposite. She has a very, very clear idea of who she is and has absolutely no intention of letting anybody else ever have any say in that. And I was thinking about how that has a good side, but it also has a downside in that we all tend to make up narratives about our lives. We all tend to have an idea about what story our life is playing out, who we are in this story, and how everything else fits into it. And I think most of us shift that story in response to the outside reality, in response to what's actually going on around us. But if you're too reluctant to allow anybody else to have any say, any input, then you can become like Antoinette, where you start bending reality in order to fit your personal narrative. And also, like the victim in The Trespasser, Ashlyn Murray, who starts deliberately trying to bend reality to fit the way she wants her personal narrative to go. And I think the underlying theme in this one is what can happen when that personal narrative gets dangerously out of control.
Right. And actually, you know, in some ways, it is that character, and I'd like to ask you to describe it a little bit more, but it is Antoinette's character that on the one hand makes her a really good cop, but also undermines her ability to be a good cop.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, she's forceful, she's savagely tough, she takes no nonsense. All of these are good things. But at the same time, being a detective involves working with other people, working as a team. And that is not necessarily one of her fortes. And she's in the murder squad, which is a very small, tight-knit, elite squad where it's got a very specific atmosphere of its own. And she got off on the wrong foot there and absolutely refuses to do anything to remedy that because, hey, why should I, basically? And that's led into a spiral where she's on the receiving end of all kinds of everything from harassment down to downright sabotage from some members of her squad. And that's got her to the point where she's so paranoid that she's no longer quite able to tell what exactly is her paranoia and what is reality. So it's had its downside, her lack of flexibility. It's got her into she's painted herself into a corner and can't get out.
And she had a previous confrontation with the person who became the murder victim. It not just affects the way she works with others, but also with how she works with the folks that she's investigating or the people who come into the station.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think she would probably tell herself that it doesn't. But the fact is that it very much does. She doesn't have a lot of patience with people who she considers to be foolish in any way. And so she ends up cutting them off, shutting them off in moments where she should be doing the opposite. It's, I guess, one of the reasons she and Stephen make a good pair is because he does the opposite. He's very open to whatever's coming in from every direction, and she isn't, and they balance each other out well.
Yeah, and for somebody who perhaps hadn't read the previous book, The Secret Place, which is told from Stephen Moran's point of view, you might be questioning his character as well if you were reading this book.
I think that's one of the advantages of switching narrators every time, is that you get to see the previous narrator from somebody else's point of view, and you get to see the new narrator from their point of view, which is a change. And nobody's view on themselves is objective reality, exactly, and nobody's view on themselves is going to be the same as a friend's or a rival's or somebody else's. And so, yeah, I hope you do find yourself questioning characters from previous books when they're seen in a different light and thinking, well, which is the real perspective? Which is the true one? It may not be that different, but the slight shifts can be crucial. What does this person mean by that? What was their actual motive? Were they being honest with themselves? Is the current narrator being honest with themselves? Who is this person really? And is it as simple as it was presented the first time?
Yeah, and before we move on from Antoinette, the big chip on her shoulder and her paranoia, I mean, it's to some degree based in fact. Tell us where it's coming from. It's not just about her personality.
No, it's not just about her personality. It stems probably, to start with, from the fact that her father ran off on her and her mother before Antoinette was born. She's never met him. And her mother spent her childhood telling Antoinette stories about who her father had been. You know, he was a Brazilian guitarist, he was a Saudi prince, he was an Egyptian doctor. And all of those stories satisfied Antoinette for a little while until she realized that there was a flaw in them and they couldn't possibly be true. And she's become very resistant to any attempt at all to define her story by other people, just furiously resistant to any attempt by anyone to define her. And when she sees that, whether her perception is real or not, when she sees that in the rest of the squad, she instantly goes furiously on the defensive. And it does track back to that early feeling that somebody else has been defining her story for her.
So I have a question that puzzles me, and you don't have to answer it if you feel it's going to give away anything in the plot that you don't want to. Okay. But she does confront her father at some point, and she utterly rejects him. Why?
I think that's very much who she is. We're kind of trained by narrative to think that everybody wants a great big emotional outburst for closure. That's the closure they want, is they want absolute emotional openness and understanding and enlightenment. But I don't think that's the kind of closure that everybody wants. I don't think everybody has a need for that. And Antoinette genuinely doesn't. The closure she wants between her and her father is for her to be the one calling the shots. That's all she wants from him. She doesn't want to know who he is and what he is and what he feels about her, and she doesn't want to cry on his shoulder and have a big huggy reunion. All she wants is for her to call the shots this time and for him not to have any power anymore over her. And while there is the instinct in her that goes, yes, let me ask all the questions, let me hear all the stories, she feels that that would be another step towards allowing him to define who she is, which in some ways he has done since day one. And she's not going to bite on that lure. She absolutely refuses. She's not going to go for what to her would be a very cheap concept of closure. She's going to go for the one that she wants.
Well, that's great. That's a very satisfying answer. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Tana French about her new novel, The Trespasser. Now, the murder victim, 26-year-old Ashlyn Murray. Now, usually the murder victim in a novel is not particularly fleshed out, at least not after their death. And she dies pretty early in this story. So, in fact, she's dead by the time the story opens. But
she's dead from day one.
She really unfolds as a character herself, which I found one of the most fascinating threads in this absolutely wonderful book. Could you talk a little bit about Ashlyn Murray?
Thank you. I mean, I hope she does. I hope she does come to life, because I think that's one of the things I don't like, is that murder mysteries, whether real or fictional, tend, not always, but it's a risk that the victim gets sidelined. And of course, the victim is the one who had most at stake in all of this, and I don't want to sideline the victim. She appears to be, from Antoinette's standpoint, basically dead Barbie. She is blonde, she's pretty, she's groomed, all her sitting room, her house is all perfect, everything's absolutely perfect. It could come from a glossy magazine. And Ashlyn puts her down as basically somebody who's turned herself into a Barbie doll. But it turns out, little by little over the course of the book, that Ashlyn was much more complicated than that. She had her own agenda. Everything she did for a very specific reason. She was not being passive in any way. She was trying to make events go the way she had planned them. And everything she did was factored towards that goal.
In a way, she was defining herself by hiding who she is.
Yes, yeah. She was creating a new her who would function as a tool for the real her. And she felt that that was something that could be done in a temporary way and then discarded when it didn't suit her needs anymore, because she didn't really have a very strong sense of who the real her was because of her own circumstances and the way that her life has been defined by her father leaving when she was 10. And she felt that she could construct a persona who would be useful for her goal and then discard it. But she didn't really understand that even if it's a constructed persona, its actions have very real consequences. You can't always control it. Things can get out of control very easily. And that's what happened.
Yeah, exactly. And now, when this case is first brought to Antoinette and Stephen, they think it's a straight up, lover's quarrel case that goes terribly wrong. They blame the boyfriend, Rory Fallon, who's a bookshop owner and a sensitive man, we should say.
A good guy.
Yeah, he is a good guy. Although Antoinette, I just have to quote this from her description of him, because it really shows the kind of fierce, savage language she uses in the book to such effect. She says, he's such a goddamn damp weenie, the kind who needs regular slaps across the back of the head just to keep him from vanishing up his own hole.
Yeah, she doesn't like him very much. But Aisling did. Mm-hmm. Aisling really, really did. That's the thing. She had found somebody who was perfect for her, but her other plans got in the way.
Yeah, exactly. I think he becomes the vehicle for some of the most gripping scenes in the book. These are interrogation scenes, which are absolutely impeccable. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your process in arriving at them, where they just seem so completely spot on and spellbinding.
Interrogation scenes, it's weird. They're actually some of the most difficult to write, because usually you've got a certain amount of room for digression. Characters can take the scene in one direction or another, the whims can come in, but in an interrogation scene, everybody involved has an absolutely clear motivation. The motivation is never going to be part of the mystery that you can slowly reveal as you go on. The detectives want the information. The other person wants to keep that information hidden. So the motives are laid out on the table already, so that kind of takes away a layer of the mystery you're able to use. And also, there are very specific markers that have to be hit along the way. This bit of information has to come out. This bit of information has to be used against the character. So you've got a structure almost inbuilt into the scene, where usually you can let it go off on its own tangent and see where that takes you. So the interrogation scenes are the most highly structured. And one of the things that makes them more interesting to write is that the detectives in an interrogation focus on the subject with such absolute intensity and such a high level of perception. They're trying to figure out who this person is, because they need to know that in as much depth as possible so that they can use the tools that will work on this particular person. What does this person want? Who will he respond to? What's he thinking? They have to be one step ahead the whole time, and that's the way they're working. It's all about a kind of enforced and terrifying intimacy that the detectives are pushing and that obviously the suspect is going to try to avoid. And that's what happens between them and Roy. They're trying to figure out who he is, what does he need, and what is the thing that we can offer him that will make him come out with all the information he's got.
And did you do any kind of research into actual interrogations, or are these really made up? Do you just have the sense of it?
No, I've watched videos of interrogations. I've read a lot of transcripts, and I've read about their specific techniques that detectives can be trained in order to do interrogations. But the thing is that you have to take a certain amount of artistic license, because a real interrogation can last 12 hours, 8 hours with breaks and all that. But it can last for hours and hours and hours. And an awful lot of that will be repetition, coming back on the same thing from different angles. Well, let's take this over again, tell us the whole story again. And in a book, that's not going to work. My books are long enough already. If I throw in a 12-hour interrogation scene, everyone's going to give up and go home, So you have to condense it. And that's the other thing that's quite difficult, because in reality, it does take time to move somebody from the point where they're absolutely not going to tell you anything to the point where they will tell you everything. And you have to find ways when you're writing a book to condense that down so that it's psychologically plausible, but it doesn't bore the reader to death.
We're talking with Tana French about her new novel, The Trespasser. And then the other aspect, the other character, and I think you already alluded to this in some way, is the squad itself, the murder squad itself. And even more so in this book. Could you talk a little bit about that, how that becomes so much of the focus of this book, although the murder victim is part of it, is really on the internal relationships of that squad?
Yeah, absolutely. For me, that you're right, the squad is a major character in this book. And the mentality that makes a detective, that was one of the main things that I was thinking about. See, I'm lucky. I know a retired detective who's been incredibly generous with his time over the last, 12 years. He has answered so many questions for me. And a couple of years back, I rang him up and I said, do you mind giving me an idea of how you would go about interrogating a suspect in this specific set of circumstances? And he said, yeah, sure. And he gave me, just off the top of his head, a quick idea, demonstration of how he would go about it using me as a hypothetical suspect, right? And it was a revelation. This genuinely lovely guy, like a really nice, sound, easygoing, friendly guy, transformed, like flicking a switch, into this full-on, unstoppable force just bearing down on me. He was the complete controller of the situation. It wasn't that he was being aggressive exactly. It was just that he was going to get what he wanted and nothing was going to stand in his way, and I had no say in this at all. I mean, he was doing this as a favor for me, and I was only on the phone, and I was leaning back in my chair against this freight train force bearing down on me. And that stuck with me, and I started to think about how that kind of power and control has to be a skill that every detective has. It just has to be. There's no other way to make people speak against their own interests. You know, a reluctant witness to give you info, a suspect to confess. You have to be able to take that kind of power and control. And then I started thinking about what it would be like working in a squad room full of a couple of dozen people who all have this skill. They all have this other mode right at their fingertips, accessible at a moment's notice. And what it would be like if it was turned on you suddenly, this force. If you were one of the detectives, you're supposed to be in a position of power here, and suddenly this force and this controlling power is being turned on you from every side and every day. And I had already written in Antoinette as not getting on well with her squad, not being very good at playing with others, and I started to think, what if that had gone wrong? What if that had gone further into a spiral? And she was feeling this coming at her the whole time. The squad room had turned from her safe place into an enemy. What would that do to her sense of reality, of herself within reality? And what if she got a case where things could be interpreted in a variety of ways and she couldn't tell how much was her paranoia and how much was reality? So the squad room, from the start of this book, was going to be the heart of it. And the atmosphere in the squad room was going to be the heart of the problem for Antoinette.
Yes, but also the whole search for the killer, her work on this case in some way parallels her own search for self, and she experiences an epiphany about herself in this book that actually changes how she sees herself in relationship to the world around her.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. She's been very convinced that she has a very clear idea of what's going on around her, and gradually over the course of the book she starts to realize that the story isn't at all what she thought it was, that there are many more shades of gray, and that she is not, in fact, necessarily the persecuted warrior going down in flames, and that it doesn't have to work that way, that she's been shaping it just as much as anybody else has, and that she has a choice, in fact, to shape it differently. And that's a very strange feeling for her, very strange and disorientating, and for her to come to terms with it, she's practically dragged kicking and screaming to that moment where she has that realization.
Now, she's the main character in this book. Do you have a vision of another book in which she'll be the minor character?
I'm actually working on the next book, but it's a little bit different. The narrator isn't a detective this time, and he hasn't appeared in any of the other books. I mean, there still is a murder in there, because I don't think I know how to write a book without throwing a dead body in there to get the action. But he's just a normal guy who, at the lowest point in his life, finds himself in the middle of a murder investigation, and he has to figure out not only what he should do about it, but also how he has wound up there to start with. So Antoinette isn't in it, as far as I know. I'm still very early on, and I don't really know where I'm going with a book before I get into it. So I'm not sure which detectives or where will show up.
Well, we really hope to talk with you about that one. And thank you so much for talking with us, Tana French, about your latest, The Trespasser. It was just a terrific read.
Thank you. And thank you so much for having me back.
Tana French is the author of 5 previous novels in the Dublin Murder Squad series, including The Secret Place, which we talked with her about in 2014. She's the winner of the Edgar Award and the Irish Book Award for Crime Fiction, among others. The Trespasser is published by Penguin Random House. Read an excerpt at writersvoice.net. Next up, Surviving the Future. Don't go away. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. As this show is being produced, world climate negotiators are meeting in Morocco to discuss implementation of the Paris Climate Accord, signed earlier this year by the U.S. and many other countries. 2016 has been the hottest year on record, and next year is predicted to be even hotter still. But on January 20th, a climate denier will become President of the United States. Many of us who think about the future all the time and the grave threats to it that climate disruption and other environmental failures pose are in a state of despair. But we really can't afford to wallow in it. We've got to roll up our sleeves and redouble our efforts to create a living future for ourselves and our children. My guest, Sean Chamberlain, is a central figure in one of the international movements that is creating that livable future, the Transition Towns Movement. He's also the author of The Transition Timeline. He's a proponent of what he calls dark optimism, which is also the name of the nonprofit he heads. Chamberlain describes dark optimism as being unashamedly positive about what kind of world humanity could create, and unashamedly realistic about how far we are from creating it today. Sean Chamberlain was a good friend of David Fleming, a great thinker and writer on environmental issues in the UK, and a leader in the Transition Towns movement and the UK Green Party. Fleming died in 2010, leaving behind a voluminous collection of writings that Chamberlain has edited and published in the form of 2 books, Lean Logic, and the one we're talking about today, Surviving the Future, Culture, Carnival, and Capital in the Aftermath of the Market Economy. Well, Sean Chamberlain, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Pleasure to be here, Francesca.
This book has a very intriguing title. Surviving the Future is only part of what's intriguing. We all want to survive the future. But the subtitle also, Culture, Carnival, and Capital. In the Aftermath of the Market Economy, culture, carnival, and capital, not words you often see together.
Yeah, sure enough. But yeah, culture, carnival, and capital. So essentially, it's about the fact that David saw the market economy as being something which is on its last legs in many ways, is likely to sort of reach its demise over the coming decades, and that looking historically is something that's only really been around for a couple of hundred years, so it's quite a short-lived way of organizing the world, if you like, and yet already seems to be hitting the buffers pretty hard. And what he saw as the alternative to the impossibility of economic growth is what's always held human cultures together in the past, which is culture and carnival and community, and really basing the cohesion of a society not on the free flow of money, but on the kind of integration that culture provides as a basis for what he calls the informal economy or the non-monetary economy, the relationships of relying on each other rather than relying on money. And he writes beautifully about the importance of things like carnival in producing the bonding that's required for a society to have cohesion without economic growth.
So now tell us a little bit about David Fleming.
Okay, so David was quite an influential guy, but in a sort of quiet way. He was involved in starting the Green Party in the UK. In fact, his flat in Hampstead, his very small flat in Hampstead, was actually the Green Party office originally back in the day in the 70s. And he was involved back then in starting something called the Other Economic Summit, which was a sort of alternative summit to the G7, as it was at the time, exploring alternative sort of economic approaches. And that birthed something called the New Economics Foundation, which is quite influential now. And he was also a chairman of the Soil Association, which is a sort of organic farming advocacy body in the UK, and very involved with the outset of the Transition Towns movement, Rob Hopkins wrote the foreword for Surviving the Future, which you will have seen. And Rob once described transition to me as just being, very humbly, I think, but he said that transition was just, he took David Holmgren on permaculture, Richard Heinberg on peak oil, and David Fleming on community resilience, rolled them together, and that was transition, sort of ready to go. And I've been doing a few talks around the books recently as they were just launched, and one was with David's great friend Jonathan Porritt. And he told me that in the 70s, when he first met David at what was then the Ecology Party conference, David was urging his contemporaries, we need to learn the language of economics, because it's the economists who keep telling us that all this environmental stuff is, you know, impractical rubbish, and we need to be able to engage with them on their terms and prove them wrong. And he was true to his word, because he went off and got a PhD in economics and also a degree in modern history. And he used these very much, unlike some people who seem to sort of study these disciplines and get sort of sucked into the assumptions of them. He very much saw it as a means to the end of confounding mainstream economics and engaging with it on its own terms and showing its absurdities, which I think is something that he does very skillfully in these books.
This book, Sean Chamberlain, Surviving the Future, is very much about the breakdown of the market system, as you said earlier, and the path to survival. It lays out four paths ahead of us to choose: growth, continuity, descent, and collapse. I wonder if we could talk first about growth, continuity, and collapse, and then we can talk about descent.
So the growth story is sort of the dominant story, I would say, in our culture. This idea that it's possible for us to continue with society and economics as it currently is, on the market economy, and that is inherently reliant on growing, as David Roth says in the book, that market economies, like bicycles, are only stable when they're moving forwards, which in the case of an economy means growth. And so we've sort of lived through this paradigm for a long time that it's possible for us to continue along that path with, you know, without having really fundamental impacts on the environment or on culture, that's actually a path that can be followed. But of course, as many of us are increasingly coming to realize, that the current path is destroying the very foundations on which it relies. And that's not just economically speaking or even ecologically speaking, but culturally speaking, it's actually destroying the sort of fabric of our society. And so that growth path is business as usual, if you like. And then the continuity idea is, you know, well, maybe we can just reform that a bit. You know, maybe we can continue growing, but simultaneously repair a lot of the problems that are there. Or maybe we could, given that seems to be actually impossible given the mathematics of growth and the implications of that, maybe we could actually somehow continue as we are but without growth itself. But again, economically speaking, that proves to be an impossibility. It's not that we could decouple, as many people are saying, where we can continue to sort of grow well-being without growth under our current economic paradigm. That mathematical impossibility. And then, of course, the collapse scenario is where we just sort of plow on through all the biophysical and economic and cultural boundaries that we're currently heading towards, and the whole thing comes crashing down around our ears. And so really the scenario which has some hope in it, I would say, is what David calls the descent scenario, which is about a managed descent where we transition from not so much focusing on what a lot of people now are calling degrowth, because within the market paradigm, degrowth is really in many ways a path to collapse, but more focusing on growth of the informal economy. So rather than worrying too much about whether the market economy is growing or not growing, and David argues very strongly that its growth is something which is probably likely to come to an end faster than we might wish it if we understood the consequences, what we need to focus on is rebuilding that informal economy, so that there's something there to catch us when the mainstream market economy's growth grinds to a halt, and we come to realise just how much we do depend on that, and how destructive in many ways it will be when that inevitably happens. So it's something that we need to prepare for. And I think what's quite important about that is that doesn't only make sense if we agree about the shape of the future that we're heading towards. I think rebuilding a sense of community and culture is something that's inherently desirable, even if we think that, you know, the mainstream economy is fine, there are no fundamental problems there at all. That's still a desirable thing to do. And so it and this is something that I found through my work with Transition, has this powerful ability to really bring together people with quite different views of the future, those who see it as a way of rebuilding something to catch us after the collapse, and those who just see it as a way of making a better life, regardless of any views about collapse in the future.
So, David Fleming, his book really reminds me, this book, Surviving the Future, reminds me of another emerging paradigm, which is the commons movement. Are you aware of that?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I find it very interesting that I see it as almost an alternative to right-wing and left-wing, if you like. And if the left-wing has this sort of great focus on the state, and the right-wing has this focus on sort of corporations and markets, then the commons and cooperative movement is in many ways an alternative path, which I find quite exciting. I've been chairing an organisation called the Ecological Land Cooperative, which is very much part of that movement and tied in with the Community Land Trust movement, providing a way for ecological projects to find land on which they can do some of the nice ecological projects that they're working for. So yes, that's something that I'm very much embedded in myself.
This is Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and I'm talking with writer, activist, and dark optimist Sean Chamberlain about the book he's edited, David Fleming, Surviving the Future. Let's talk about the vision that David Fleming laid out in this book. First of all, he talks about the climacteric, which is the situation that we are now in. Tell us what it is, and also what were some of his thoughts about when it comes to its own climax.
So climacteric is probably a word that doesn't have that much currency, but it's often used in early medical thinking. It was this idea that there are sort of key intervals in human life, either every 7 years or every 14 years. So they felt that, you know, particularly significant events happened in your life, say at the ages of 7 and 21 and 35 and 49. And this sort of name has survived. It's often used now for kind of midlife hormonal changes. But David really uses it with regard to our society and a climacteric that we're facing with this sort of convergence of the various challenges that we see developing around us, whether that be climate change, whether that be deficits in energy and food and water, or depletion of soils, or all of these multiple crises which seem to be converging. And climacteric is the term that David uses to kind of pull all of those together when he wants to talk about them collectively. And he sees that the market economy is really reaching its crunch point in the early decades of this century. So David passed away at the end of 2010. But again, I think what's really important is not the moment when the crash will happen. What's important is building the sequel, if you like, to our present society, building that sort of decentralized, low-impact human ecology, which is not only, I think, what David advocates, and indeed what I advocate, but also is historically the thing that has always carried the human story forward through times of crisis. We have this quite kind of obsession with the quote great civilizations, and I think archaeologists in particular are always fascinated by them because they're what leave the spectacular architecture, etc., that they like to investigate. But in fact, it's questionable whether the so-called great civilizations were actually the form of society that made the most sense, if you like, that had the most resilience, that had brought the most joy to the people who lived in them. And so, yeah, David's vision is really about bringing control back to the local level, back to community, and relying on the brilliance and ingenuity of people rather than of top-down societal structures as the path to a better future.
One thinks, for the example in this country, let's say, of the Aztec civilization, and then, or even of the southwestern civilizations that then succumbed to climate change, prolonged drought, and yet there are the communities, the Pueblo communities in southwestern United States that still remain. Is that some of the idea that enlivens this book?
Well, absolutely, yeah, and David calls on a number of historical examples, especially, I should explain, there are actually two books here. So David's life's work was, it's called Lean Logic, A Dictionary for the Future and How to Survive It. When David passed away very suddenly at the end of 2010, he was actively working on this book at the time. And I've been working very closely with David, and not on this book, but on other projects. And when I found the manuscript on his computer after his death, I was very powerfully struck by what an important work it was. And so started talking to publishers about getting it over the finishing line and getting it published. But it's a huge book. It's, I think, about 350,000 words, and it's in this dictionary format. So it's a little like Wikipedia. It has sort of links between the entries, little stars next to words that have their own entry. And that creates a sort of choose-your-own-adventure path, if you like, where you can follow the path of your own interest. But some publishers that I spoke to were saying, wow, you know, this is an incredible book, but it's quite daunting for people because it's unconventionally formatted and because it's so long. So I then undertook creating the paperback version, which we've been talking about, Surviving the Future. And that's, as you know, a much more conventionally formatted read it front to back book. But all of the content is taken from the from David's life work, Lean Logic. So there's these two sort of companion books, if you like. And Surviving the Future, I hope, is a sort of a gateway drug, if you like, to the full work, Lean Logic. And in Lean Logic, there's a great deal more history, if you like, a great deal more looking at the historical examples like the one that you quote, show that this is a way of life that has the capacity to continue functioning through times of collapse, which do happen throughout human history, and which it looks like we might be on the cusp of facing ourselves.
So this is from Lean Logic to Lean Thinking. Describe the lean economy that this book goes into.
So lean thinking, for those who are not familiar, is more commonly known in the field of industry. It came out of the Japanese car manufacturers. And the fundamental idea that David takes from that is the notion of the people who are doing the work being the ones who really know what's going on. So if you're, for example, on a production line, it doesn't really make sense for you to think, oh, something needs to be done differently, so I'll report that to management. Management will think about it, and they'll make a decision, then they'll feed it back down the line to someone else. It makes much more sense to just talk to the person next to you and say, hey, if you did this way, then it would make my job a lot easier. And really, David's whole philosophy is based around this bottom-up idea of people who are wanting to do something together, getting together and doing it, rather than being told how to do it by anyone else. But rather uniquely, he takes this sort of idea of lean bottom-up thinking and applies it to the task not of making cars, for example, but to the task of inventing a new future for ourselves collectively. And so that, I think, is the fundamental idea, is building our economies around community, around bottom-up community, and in particular around this idea of culture, which is something which comes through again and again in David's work, the importance of having a collective story to tell. So it's not that we just sort of get together. I mean, this is, I think, I was involved with the origins of the Transition Towns movement and wrote the second transition book, The Transition Timeline. I think one of the challenges we faced in transition is that very often it becomes people sort of meeting every Thursday to do community, if you like. And of course, community doesn't really work like that. What actually creates a community is needing each other. Is relying on each other for things that you can't get anywhere else. So whereas in a conventional sort of market economy relationship, you might get your food from the supermarket, and if you fall out with the worker on the checkout, well, that's not really a problem because you just go to a different worker or you go to a different supermarket. But in a true community, if you fall out with someone, you kind of have to make that work because maybe they're the person who, you know, grows the food, or they're the person who makes the tools that you need, or whatever it may be. And so it's rediscovering this sense of really needing each other and really caring about each other and playing together. And play is an absolutely core concept in both books. This notion that play is the way that we bond and that we connect. And so, yeah, basing an economy very much on relationships rather than on transactions.
We live in a world that is increasingly diverse, and as this collapse happens, it's going to become more diverse with probably a huge influx of climate refugees, which has already begun. How are we going to integrate the need for diversity into this creation of community? Because so often in human history, Community has been not only defined by being together with those around you, but also being against those who are coming in from outside.
And this, I mean, you talk about the influx of people. Of course, there's also a great outflux from certain places. But presumably you're talking in the sort of American or UK context where I'm based. And this is something which actually I found David writes particularly insightfully about. Of course, here in the UK, we've got this ongoing story of Brexit at the moment. And we had this vote a few months ago, which narrowly came down on the side of Leave. And while I've been on the tour for these books, Brexit has been something which has come up again and again and again. And of course, when we were in the build-up to the vote, I was completely immersed in my work on these books. And it was the first vote as sort of part of the electorate that I've been asked to take part of, where it wasn't immediately clear to me which way I would vote. I sort of, on the one hand, had this sense from a transition perspective, I suppose, of wanting to see control and power brought back more towards the local level and away from these sort of supranational entities like the EU. But at the same time, you know, I have this fundamental belief that border controls are inherently racist, actually, that the idea that someone should only be allowed to choose where they live based on their place of birth, I find, you know, morally inappropriate. And so I think one of the things that I found very helpful is that David's work, unlike the mainstream media discourse, got quite deeply into the nuance of this. So in the media, we keep hearing this sort of very superficial sort of name-calling debate, like the idea that anyone who voted to leave the European Union is either an idiot or a racist seems to be the main sort of narrative at the moment. And I find that quite inappropriate, actually. So David's work talks a lot about, I mean, you mentioned the Commons earlier, and he draws very heavily on the work of the late Eleanor Ostrom, the Nobel Prize-winning economist who did a lot of glorious work around the Commons. And one of the things which she emphasises around the Commons is that they have to be closed access, that there is a limit to the amount of, well, the number of people or other users that a commons can support. And so if there's an endless influx, then that is going to be overwhelmed. And that, I think, is just an ecological reality. I mean, that's what works like the limits to growth are all about. At the same time, on the flip side, there's nothing to say that the people who should be able to access those commons are necessarily the people who were born there. It must be the people who don't act as free riders on those commons who take some responsibility for the well-being of that place. And I mean, in my experience, I formerly ran a project for young asylum seekers here in the UK, and my experience is that actually the free riders on our ecological commons are very often not the incomers; they're very often the natives here, and it's been one of the shortcomings of the mainstream debate is this assumption that, you know, of course anyone who was born in the UK should have the right to continue to use the resources and live in the UK. But actually, if we're going to have a future that makes sense ecologically, there is some kind of responsibility that comes with that right. And it isn't whether you're born here or not that determines whether you're exercising or fulfilling those responsibilities. It's very much more about your engagement. But, of course, that leaves the problem. If you do have freedom of movement, and David was a great advocate for freedom, then commons are potentially going to be overwhelmed. So if you're not going to have very strict border controls, how are you going to control commons from getting overwhelmed? And David's solution, I think, is a unique one and quite a beautiful one, which is about helping the creation of a love of the place that you're in. Because the majority of people who are looking to leave their homes and go somewhere else, it's not because they hate their home. It's not because they want to be far away from their family. It's not because they want to be far away from the culture that they know and they grew up in. It's because problems are being visited on them, whether by climate change, whether by invasion and war, whether by the depredations of the neoliberal market economy, looking at places like Greece. And so really what we should be doing is looking to rebuild community and culture so that actually the most effective barrier to exit from a place, if you like, is the desire to stay there and the love of the place. And that really is the vision that I find quite inspiring in David's work. He lays out an economics based around diversity and loyalty, which I think is maybe the only realistic alternative to the quite fascist future that seems to be increasingly dominating. I mean, I know a lot of people who voted out or leave in the Brexit vote who did so for very, very reasonable reasons, that the narrative of the outvote is increasingly being controlled by this very sort of xenophobic, even racist narrative, which is a shame because I think there is something very important about the national identity, about what it means to be we, what it means to have a national interest, which is not xenophobic, but is about loving the place that you're in. And that's one of the reasons why I'm so proud to be associated with these books, because I think they are, while the current neoliberal economy is destroying our future, it's also destroying the present for a huge number of people who are being ground into the dirt right now. And these books, I think, tell a beautiful story of how we could make the future better for the desperate rather than the fearful one, which is sadly currently dominating.
Yes, it's very beautiful and hopeful in that way. And yet I had this nagging voice as I read this book, Surviving the Future, by David Fleming, which you, Sean Chamberlain, have edited, that what if we've gone too far already? In other words, you know, the descent is something, you know, a more gentle, long descent that has been envisioned by this book and by others. But collapse seems to be the way we seem to be going, not just in history, but now. And in history, the collapses were local. This time it's worldwide, it's global. So how do you see this vision working practically right now with the overwhelming challenges that we face?
Well, I think you're right. I think we absolutely face a timing problem. I think that the rebuilding of cultural integrity is something that takes time, and we're in a situation where we face a real challenge of timing. And I think, as David says throughout the book, in a way, we shouldn't get too hung up on our predictions of what the future is likely to look like. I'd actually like to read a little section from his entry on success in the dictionary. So this is something that didn't make it into Surviving the Future. And he says, "Do you really think that we will get through the climacteric and come in due course to a time of resilience, manners, and harmonic order? Don't answer that question, for you may discover to your cost that your answer is either a self-fulfilling or a self-denying truth, and that both count against us. If we deny that there is a livable future, then we will do little to secure one. If we affirm it, we come into other troubles, such as complacency, an optimistic view that what we are doing now is all that is needed, an iconic focus on the simple solution, or the constant anxiety of life on the edge between hope and doubt. Positive thinking seems to be the right thing in the circumstances, until you notice the wreckage. Instead, think of what happened to Orpheus and Eurydice. Eurydice, you may remember, died after having been bitten by a snake, and Orpheus went down into the underworld to recover her. The goddess Persephone agreed to let her go on condition that Orpheus did not look back at her as she followed him. Unfortunately, he forgot about this condition. He did look back, with the result that Eurydice vanished forever, and Orpheus was torn to pieces by angry women who threw his head into the river Hebros, where it floated downstream, still singing. That is, make the intense commitment. At walking pace, plod on, climb steeply uphill out of the underworld, keep your eyes fixed ahead. You never know, you might get there, you might even find out where there is, and you might inspire others to come with you. Just don't look back. We do not need to choose between hope and expectation. What matters is to keep hope alive, which we won't succeed in doing if we are constantly checking up on it. It is not certainty that sustains our focus, but the ambiguity that comes to us, for instance, in the prayer from another ancient moment of commitment against the odds, quote, Lord, I believe, help thou mine unbelief. And I think that really sums up the time we're in. I mean, one of my favourite song lyrics at the moment is, it feels like we're living in that split second of a car crash. And in these times, I find that, you know, talking to a lot of people, especially environmentalists, there's this constant argument that I hear where on the one side people saying, well, we don't have time for radical change. You know, everything's so urgent. We have to act within the frameworks that we've got now. And on the other hand, people are saying, well, hang on, if we don't fundamentally change the paradigm, we're just dealing with symptoms and we're not dealing with the underlying problem. And I hear this argument again and again in every single field that I look at. And I think the thing that both sides of that argument fail to acknowledge is that they're both right. Actually, we do need fundamental change, and there isn't time for it. And it's very easy to understand why people are afraid to admit that, because if you admit that, then you say, well, hang on, so what then? And at that point, I think you have to go through, as I'm sure you have, that sort of dark night of the soul where you sit with this and you think, well, okay, so, you know, what is my future going to look like? And maybe I do live in a world of collapse, and maybe it's not within my power to head that off. But I find one of the most powerful experiences that we can have, actually, is that dark night of the soul, that letting go of our sense of control, if you like, that letting go of our sense of certainty. And then it feels terrifying. It feels like it might end you to admit that. But when you do admit that, it doesn't end you. And eventually you wake up the next day and maybe you look at the world a bit differently. Maybe you think, well, okay, so maybe I even live in a dying world, but I'm still here. So what story do I want to tell with my life during the time that I have? Because I think if we make sustainability our God, we'll fail our God, because ultimately, you know, we all die, we're all human, and ultimately, you know, the sun's going to burn out if we want to take sustainability to the extreme. So we can never achieve perfect sustainability, but what we can achieve is telling a story with our lives that we're proud to tell while we're here. And for me, David Fleming's vision of a society based again in this sense of community and of love and of culture is something that I find, it's the story I want to tell with my life. And if we're heading into a collapse scenario, then I want to go into that scenario with a tight-knit community of people that I believe in and who believe in me, and that will make the future better than it would otherwise be. And if we're not heading into a collapse scenario, then that's also the work I want to do towards the future I want to live in. So in a way, as David stresses throughout, I don't think we should get too hung up on what we believe the future will look like. What we should be hung up on is, what can I do to make the future more like the future I want to live in?
Well, that's very beautiful and a good place to end. Sean Chamberlain, you are the editor of David Fleming's Surviving the Future. Thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
An absolute pleasure, Francesca.
Sean Chamberlain. You can read an excerpt from Surviving the Future at writersvoice.net. And while you're there, don't forget to sign up for our free podcast and newsletter. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.